Welcome to The Systemic Way. In today's episode, Cesar and I are talking to Amanda Middleton. Amanda is a queer systemic family psychotherapist working with queer relationships and families. She lectures across the UK and is a trainer, supervisor, and consultant on all things therapeutic and queer. She has been involved with many projects, including More Adventures. She has published in 2022 articles such as Adventures in Time, Gender and Therapeutic Practice, Embracing a Queer Systemic Way of Working with Gender Expansive Families. Amanda has also done a lot of teaching and training, delivering lectures and conference keynotes, running workshops and professional development training with a range of organisations across statutory and voluntary and independent sectors. She's keen to extend thinking and practice, grounded with a mixture of theory, practice, humour and reflection, and she often teaches on working alongside LGBTQIA people, relationships and families, and embedding intersectional approaches in therapy. Today, we're going to be speaking with Amanda about her keynote speech that she gave at the AFT conference in 2022. She's also going to be taking us beyond that into her practice, the pink practice, and also shares some of the projects that she's also been informed of. She expands on the keynote speech and invites us to deepen our relationship when thinking about gender. I paused there because immediately when I started talking about Amanda there, I thought about a disco ball and dancing, because I know that's sort of one of the metaphors that Amanda uses. And I think it kind of summarizes our conversation in some ways, Cesar, that we had with her. She sparkled. There were many different facets, and she invited us to go on a journey with her in terms of thinking, rethinking gender and how we might feel about it, what we might think about it, and how we might talk about it. Is there anything you'd like to add, Cesar?
Thanks, Julie, for that introduction to Amanda's work and our episode. I mean, the words that you said that struck me as you were saying it were like extend and expand, because in listening to Amanda, I've always felt like she's pulled me into this like world of adventure, of like the depth of ideas that I'm like frantically taking notes for, like words to like Google as soon as we finish and concepts to explore. So I find Amanda fantastic to listen to, and the podcast episode with her stretched me in many ways, actually left me with so many thoughts and ideas and places to go and explore and learn more about. The conversation we had with her around chrononormativity stuck out for me, because there was a concept that I thought I understood and used in my work, and then hearing Amanda talk about it more and again, I was like, okay, that's taking me to a whole nother level and step in my thinking. You know, I always get this with Amanda. It's the kind of idea of after I've listened to her, I realize how much I don't know about things, and sends me into directions or things to kind of wonder and be curious about. So yeah, I think it's a really poignant episode and something, really important messages and ideas that people need to hold in their practice. And yeah, we hope everybody enjoys the episode, and please do share your thoughts and ideas with us via our social medias. We really want to hear from people and how these kind of podcasts land, and have some conversations about these episodes. So yeah, thank you. Welcome, Amanda Middleton, to the Systemic Way podcast. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited about what we might get to talk about.
It's a big honor to have you here. We're awestruck, really, by your talk that you gave at the AFT conference and the depth of your keynote. It just took me in so many directions of where I want to stretch myself in thinking about these ideas that you spoke about. And today we're really going to focus on the keynote, but the paper that you wrote in Murmurations. And if I can read the title out for people, called Adventures in Time, gender and therapeutic practice, embracing a queer systemic way of working with gender expansive families. So yes, so thank you for agreeing to come and talking a bit more about the paper.
Oh, and thank you for helping expand the ideas.
Yeah, thanks, Amanda. I mean, I wanted to say I'm extremely excited and I can feel that in my body to be having this conversation with you. But alongside that, I also find it really emotional. And I don't know exactly what that is in me, but I just wanted to name it here at the beginning of this episode, because I think, yeah, there's a lot in this area.
Even if we don't think about it very much, our gender is very precious to us. It's a site where so much of us gets formed, gets experienced, it relates to other people, you know, is related to by the world. And so it I think it is always surprisingly emotional when we begin to kind of unpack what gender is and how it shapes us, really. And, you know, and also in terms of thinking about the shifts that are happening at the moment around gendered and gendered conversations, there's a lot of change around us. And I think, you know, change can bring up different emotions as well.
Absolutely. And I know that we'll get to this later in the conversation, but I know in terms of your paper and your speech, there's a lot that you speak about around the history of it. And I think when I just hearing you talk now, I think I was so unaware, let's say, of the history of how we get to binary views on gender. And I think there's something that I find quite emotional about that, of my understanding of gender. But we'll get there. To start with, though, Amanda, I was really interested to hear from you what inspired you to explore the intersection of time, gender, and sexuality in that keynote speech and in your paper.
That's a good question. I think gender and sexuality have occupied me for many years. You know, it is. I think gender, sexuality, and power is often the thing that you know, if I'm not sleeping, I'm wandering around the house thinking about those things. And that's probably because they've been such active parts of my life and of my sort of becoming of myself. And I'm so much part of communities that are thinking about sexuality and gender. And time, I think, time's come more recently as a kind of an area that I find myself thinking and experiencing more. And how our understanding of time is also quite modern, quite new, and hasn't always been this way. And I wonder sometimes whether that's because, I don't know, I'm a dyslexic person, or I always feel sometimes a bit out of time. And also because of, I think, thinking about systemic theory and the way that things like the life cycle and timelines form such a basis of thinking about how things should be. And I guess I've felt out of step with those at lots of times in my life. So it's been, it's kind of been a lot of different tendrils have gotten me to this point. Of thinking about time, sexuality, and gender, as well as the project that's very much featured in the keynote, the More Adventures project, which is linked specifically to a project around how ideas about gender and sexuality have been shaped across different times within Western thought.
Thanks, Amanda. I just also wanted to add, because I know when I heard you talk, and I know it's also in the Memorations article, that you had this acknowledgement about you talking and writing the words that you do in a specific time, and an acknowledgement to the future. And I don't know, maybe it feels like maybe it's important to do that even in this conversation. And I know you'll do it more articulately than me. So please, if you feel to.
I think language moves really quickly. And it particularly moves quickly within kind of our understandings of gender and sexuality. And we're in a time at the moment where there's lots of proliferation of new language, or reclaiming of old language, or kind of hybriding of terms to create more scope, more possibility for language. And so I always think about the language. You know, I've been in practice more than 20 years, and a lot of that has been working with LGBT people, people questioning their gender. And I think about the language that may be used at the beginning of my career and how different it is to now. And so I really always acknowledge that the language that I'm using now might feel out of step or old or dated or maybe even offensive in the future. And so I think it's important that we do kind of name that especially with artifacts like podcasts and writing that exist beyond the moment, it's important to acknowledge that these artifacts might date and to kind of I just think it's important that people know things happen within time and context.
In your paper and also in your talk, you play with time, don't you? This kind of time travel. And just that, what you've just said, is it's almost like talking to your future self, right? And people in the future hearing this conversation saying there was this kind of thought to the future. It's a really gentle exploration of shifting thoughts and shifting ideas, but really powerful.
Mm-hmm. But one of the things that's really attracted me to systemic thinking in the beginning was the way that it had scope for doing time differently within therapy, because we're not based in a kind of developmental theory or ideas around catharsis or particular ideas around this happens and produces who you are. Within systemic, we're much more able, I think, to deal with the present and maybe even move forward into the future before we move back. And for me, that's always been a really exciting part of systemic work. If we think about papers that take us into hope, or papers that take us into preferred selves, pieces of work that allow us dreaming, fantasy, different visions of the future, and that has potential for kind of making change with who we are now. For me, that's always felt quite revolutionary compared to other ways of doing time within other models.
In the paper, you also talk about the kind of systemic psychotherapy's history of these kind of what you say the bold epistemological shifts, and thinking about the colonizing the system of gender being the important one where we need to go to now and next. And there's a quote, if I can find it, it's a really beautiful quote, and I'll just the opportunity for you to explore it a little bit more. Many people find themselves living with the contradiction of being immersed in the gender binary while simultaneously witnessing and participating in its crumbling. The totalitarian regime of sex and gender as binary truths is unraveling, and many of us are part of this shifting binary paradigm. It is exciting and scary, with many of us bearing witness to it in ourselves, in our families, in our communities, and in our therapy practices. And I wanted to offer you just the space, really, to talk about more of those kind of the scariness and the exciting and those kind of big feelings around this paradigm shifts, and just to what you mean by those two kind of main kind of responses to this paradigm shift.
Mm. Well, I like that idea that fear and excitement are kind of two experiences very close to each other. And I think there is something really exciting about a world that involves more space for more ways of being gendered and is able to kind of let go or kind of get more fuzzy with the concepts of masculinity and femininity, and how they've been such kind of really strong tenets of how we understand gender, how we understand personhood. And yet at the same time, because those things are so structural in our world, they are the bathrooms that we go to, they are the sections that we shop in, and they are the kind of sometimes the groups we divide into, or the way we consider ourselves to be a sister or a brother. You know, they're so embedded in our relational worlds that there is something comforting about them. And I think that that's the period that we're in, is this exciting time where some of that is shifting, or we're being invited to think about some of that differently. And I think it's a long process, isn't it? This idea of anything being new or quick, I want to sort of throw out the window. But there is a sort of a movement that I think we're part of at the moment that I hope gives us more scope for being gendered beings or beyond gender in parts of our relationships. But how do we do that when there is this kind of like structural system that structures so much of our relational world and our physical world? So I think that's the tension between the fear and the excitement. And I do think, you know, invitations to difference can be very scary for people. Mm-hmm. And at the moment we are seeing many people who are, I might think about them as being afraid of gender becoming more expansive, gender becoming something that's more fluid or more has more of a multiplicious angle or multiplicious possibilities. And it's really interesting to be with families and watch that, you know, that when gender changes in a family, when someone's gender comes to be known as different, that perhaps some people are frightened of that and what it might mean for them. And their own experience of gender. So yeah, I think that's the time that we're in.
What factors or what ideas do you think might have led to that shift happening in this time now, in when it's happening, mm-hmm. you know, rather than before, I suppose?
Mm. I think it has been happening before, and then it was taken away. If we look at the More Adventures in Time and Gender yeah. project and the work that they did around the sexology and the kind of clinical work that was happening around gender and sexuality in Berlin before the war, what we see is that there was a great expansiveness of gender and sexual possibilities, and people were kind of living truths that very much feel like some of the truths that people are living now. And of course, in different places in the world, the kinds of expansion of gender that we're experiencing in white Western cultures has been there, you know, and has been being done for a long time. I think Preciado, who I reference a lot in the paper, Paul Preciado, who's a trans philosopher, he talks about this shift happening with things like the advent of the pill. And that changing the reality for many cis women around choices about what's possible within womanhood if you don't have the burden of fertility always attached to sexuality. Also, if we think about in the 1940s, we think about the kind of invention of gender identity as a concept coming out of John Money's clinic, this idea that somehow that gender is different to sex, biological sex is a concept that, again, is quite new within white Western concepts. And I also think the internet's really important. So where we think about that very important phrase, trans people have always existed, we might have had so many people living their lives as trans people, but not telling other people that they were trans, not maybe having the language for that. And with the internet, we find more people able to find language that might make sense to them, to connect with other people and to experience a kind of knowing of themselves that's more collective. So I'm not saying that the internet is making more trans people, because we know that that is, you know, of course, one of the kind of critical theories. But instead that the internet is providing space for people to come across language. There's some really interesting thinking about the proliferation of loads of different kind of language categories for gender and sexuality. You know, if we look at Facebook, there's like 72, I think, different genders that you can put on your profile to be. Part of that comes down to, if we think about that blank Google search bar and the idea that we need to kind of put language into that in order for it to give us something back, we're in a very direct relationship with language creation in that moment, and with our potential to kind of to use language as a way to find out information and to seek out others. So I think that's important. I also think there's something about safety that's really important. You know, the more safety we create in a world, the more potential we have for expanding ourselves or moving into different ways of being. And here I really like the work of Julia Serrano, who's a trans journalist. And she talks about the kind of the huge proliferation in people becoming left-handed at the turn of the century. And the way that before the turn of the century, if you were left-handed, it was seen as a terrible thing to be. You know, it might have been ungodly. It might have been meant that you were slow or different or not normal in some way. You might have been punished. You might have had your left hand tied behind your back. You might have had all these things happen. And as soon as that stigma changes, as soon as we come to understand left-handedness as a fabulous way of using hands, of being human, then suddenly the numbers of people that we know are left-handed begins to grow. And I think it's very similar in terms of as we decrease the stigma of being queer, of being gay, of being trans, then more and more people are able to kind of live that reality in an out loud way, rather than in a secretive or a stigmatized way. So I think there's lots of kind of factors that play into why now.
I'm thinking about the response to it as well. You know, if we're thinking about this kind of fear that exists around paradigm shifts and the shift and kind of unraveling these gendered binaries, and then we've seen culturally a very vile and aggressive and toxic in some quarters of society response to this as well, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if we're thinking about safety, how that kind of response that we get from that we hear in the mainstream now, you know, even in the latest government discussions, the impact that this has on people's mental health. And in your experience of working with people, the impact of that side of it that's having, so even though they on one sense culturally there's this, a safety that's being created that's allowing people to be themselves, this freedom that comes with it, but then there's also this danger response that's also spiking at the same time.
It's a backlash. I think about that idea of when we speak truth to power, there is often a backlash. And the systems that support binary gender, that support heteronormativity, are hugely powerful and don't necessarily want to give up that power. I think the kind of current really difficult context for trans people at the moment in the media, and the way in which minorities of lots of descriptions are being used to create a culture of division, a culture of fear, a culture of there's not going to be enough for me, or I'm not going to be safe in some way, which is the theme. If you look at the discourses around that are being kind of the discourses around the kind of danger of refugees, the danger of immigration, and the danger of trans people, those discourses map onto each other very closely, which speak to the idea that we're inviting people who are not those people to feel that those people are a threat to them, and that something about their world will be made unsafe by the presence or the liberation of refugees, immigrants, trans people, people of colour. And it's a very well-trodden cultural path to demonise. And if we think about some of the narratives at the moment around the trans community, they feel so similar as well to the kind of late 80s, early 90s narratives, which are really demonizing gay people in terms of gay people being unsafe, not allowed to be teachers, not allowed to be around children, HIV, you know, people with HIV needing to go and live on an island, you know, and these kind of, these ideas of contamination and separation, which are so, so strong when it comes to this kind of, this particular culture that we find ourselves in at the moment. And I think that is really damaging for people. I think it makes it much more hard, like much harder just to be yourself and to exist in the world when you're being told all of these things. And I think that's certainly what I see in my practice, is these ideas in wider culture, you know, nothing is ever just the system, and nothing's ever just individual. So conversations that we have through newspapers, through the media, through the news, show up in people's understanding of their selfhood as internalized transphobia, as feelings of very real feelings of it's not safe to be me, or I'm not welcome to be me, in different spaces. And that does alter the course of people's lives. And I think it is particularly difficult right now in terms of the political and cultural context that we find ourselves in. I think there is something really important in understanding, and I think this is where as therapists it can be really important that we're aware of the discourses around us and how that affects and shapes our own thinking. So if we think about how much media, the huge proliferation of focus on in the media on trans people, which has grown by hundreds and hundreds of percent in the last few years, therapists are going to be walking around in the world taking up some of that news. So it makes sense then that that news will show itself in our practice in some way, in our questions. And I guess the invitation that I'm making in the paper is for us to really understand and be aware of, to make visible that that way that we as therapists exist in the world and take up ideas which might not be helpful or might have agendas that we don't want to be part of within them.
I wanted to ask, Matt, you were going along, I had this question in my head, and I hope there's something to add in, because I was wondering what ideas you have that what might be a sort of risk-taking position as a therapist in regards to being in a room with gender and sexuality and dealing with those things and attending to them, or what might feel like a risk-taking position, I suppose, to challenge, like you were saying, if we think of those discourses perhaps living in us in some way. Mm-hmm. And we open ourselves up to that.
I think it's always important to think that gender and sexuality live in people, and to really humanize that, to think about a gender diverse person, a gay person, a queer person. And so I think in some ways there is this broader discussion, and there is lots of academic literature, lots of kind of papers that we can think about in terms of the ideas level. But when we're with people, we're with people. And that is really important to be in the humanness of how gender diversity is being lived and experienced. I think the risk for therapists at the moment, and I think it's a risk, the risk-taking position, it's not just about gender and sexuality, but it's about where we are as therapists in this particular place and time, is about how we acknowledge the politics of therapy, the power differentials in everyday life, and whether or not we take up that kind of mantle that the job of the therapist is to give voice to the most marginalized in the room, and how that sits, I think, the tension within family therapy of how that sits alongside, you know, lots of kind of wisdom we have in the field about staying connected and engaged to everybody, about joining with a family system. When we're often joining with a family system where all of these kind of cultural narratives are being played out by different people in the family. So I think that's the trickiness of the therapist position. The risk is, how do we name that power works? How do we sometimes make sure that we're working in a way which is about giving voice to the most marginalized in the room, even if that means that we perhaps lose for a moment engagement with other people, or that it might feel risky in that way. The risk of being a therapist at this time, the risk-taking position, is to say, is to believe people for in who they say they are, is to acknowledge that that power exists, and that people who have come have marginal identities in many ways, but that's going to affect their ability to be in the space and is worthy of our attention and conversation. Does that answer the question, Julie? Yeah. I don't know.
No, I think you have answered the question. And I don't know if I'm going to the right place, because it made me think of, and I wanted to use a quote that you use in your paper, which is from Gwynne Daniels, which is, and I hope I'm using it in the right way, but it came to me, so I'll do my best. When Gwynne lecturing a group of systemic trainees just as the war in Ukraine was breaking out, said that the purpose of violence was to stop us thinking, and reminding us that continuing to think when violence is present is partly how we resist. And I was connecting that to what you were saying in a way about risk-taking, is to be aware maybe about how we may not be thinking, and how that violence about ideas and discourses around trans people might be out there, and how we can resist that with expanding all the time our thinking. I don't know if I've got that right, but...
No, you really have. It's a really lovely way to think about it. And that if we just perpetuate some of the discourses that are in society at the moment, we will be participating in violence. And if we don't stop and think, that might be a really, that it's a really important part of our practice. I was always really moved by that moment. It stayed with me a long time. Hearing Gwynne talk in that way, as someone who's worked a lot in the context of violence and refugees, and at really, I think, the front line of how do we bear witness to some to violence and not be silenced by it, not be stopped by it, not be stuck by it. And I think that's the job of the therapist, is to help people think through some of these very, very difficult times and very difficult situations. Because my worry is that the violence that's perpetuated by the discourses in society then is repeated within the family, and people fall out, lose contact, can't have relationships with each other. That bridge between them becomes broken because of some wider ideas. And I think that's a really sad to witness when it happens, and it's a really sad part, I think, of often the reality of queer and LGBT lives, is the way in which families have become disconnected, or people have become disconnected from families.
One of the terms you use is idea of chrononormativity. Really stuck out for me, and you said it was of particular kind of significance for queer and trans people. And if you could just tell us what the term chrononormativity means, what that covers, and how in its more how it impacts queer and trans people.
I really like that when you start questioning normativity in one area, it kind of gets you questioning normativities in other areas. And that kind of lovely kind of expansion of our reflexive muscles in our brain, that as soon as we start to question, we sort of, you know, it keeps going. And so chrononormativity is an idea that has come out of thinking about our relationship to time under capitalism, and the idea that we are sort of cajoled into thinking about time in certain ways that makes us productive, and that makes us manage our time sort of in service to the capitalist system, is one of the origins of the term. Where it shows up, I think, a lot for trans and queer and LGBT people is to be thinking about how, and particularly in families, is to be thinking about how time is regulated in terms of development, to think about the often the right or the wrong times to be doing something, or how we consider people to be mature or not mature based on certain standards of heteronormativity. So, for instance, we know that for loads of young LGBT people, there isn't the opportunity, or there hasn't been the opportunity, to kind of be themselves, be out, experiment with relationships, date, fall in love, all of those kind of lovely things that we think about as being, for some young people, part of adolescence or late adolescence. And so there's this kind of time lag, this living in different times when you come to know yourself and when you begin to kind of like date and get about, that you might feel out of sync with some of your peers. So working with people who come to know themselves as gay or trans later in life, in their 40s and their 50s and their 60s, are experiencing things which people would often think about as happening in adolescence. And so time becomes then a way in which we sort of evaluate and rate life. We know that LGBT people are more likely to have experiences of sex in relationships later than their heterosexual peers, for many of them, not everyone. And every time I talk like this, I think, oh, you know, this is a kind of, I can't make broad statements and claim truths as a good social constructionist and as someone who's always trying to hold the kind of the richness and the multiplicity of experience. But, you know, there's lots of research that says we come out later, we often have children later, we have find ourselves our feet in terms of careers and development later. And so often we can be seen as sort of out of step in some way with our peers. And in terms of thinking about gender and gender diversity, and gender expansiveness, I've always noticed the way time is often part of the conversation when we're talking with families. Like the person is too young to know that they're not at the right time to know themselves. Or people might be saying, it's too late for me. I've left it too late, therefore I can't. And so time becomes really alive. And I think there are these kind of produced kind of big grand narratives or cultural stories that say, there is a particular way to do life, and it involves doing things at a certain time, at a certain age, at a certain time of the day, at a certain day of the week. And if you don't do them in that way, you're out of step or deviant in some way. And I think life then sets up this idea that LGBT people are out of step for falling outside of the life cycle as it's being produced as a sort of heteronormative artifact, really. And I think it's important to acknowledge that there has been attempts at writing life cycles and family life cycles that that account for gay and lesbian life differently. They haven't been done, to my knowledge, around trans people and gender diversity. But there are attempts at alternatives. And there's a lovely one, I can't remember the author, but there's a lovely spiral model that I think can be more useful sometimes.
Are you going to ask something, Cesar?
No, I was just really just listening and taking in the answer, really. And because the concept of chrononormativity itself feels like a really important one to I think, I don't know if it's when that word came about or who coined it or anything, but you was the first person I heard use the term. And since then, it's a regular thing I talk about with young people in my work, you know, this kind of concept of matching up to peers and this fear that exists of, oh, all my friends have gone to university and I've been left behind. And it's just constant thing that we have as humans, right, of measuring ourselves against these kind of constructed norms of ideas of what we should be doing. But just hearing you talk about how magnified that is for marginalized groups.
Yeah, I think once you start, because we're such, you know, we're relational creatures, we're always thinking about us, the self in relation to the other. As soon as you start to notice how much time exists as a concept within that relationality, we start to see how much we are measuring ourselves against these kind of ideas of time and normalness. And I think it's, yes, it can be particularly important in particular ways for queer people. But I really like what you're saying in terms of, like, I remember the first time I heard the term, I was like, this is great. I can kind of now understand lots of maybe how I've left to be feel a bit out of step or a bit out of time. Maybe how I understand that sometimes relationally I'm seen as very kind of like, I don't know, old, wise, and other times I'm seen relationally as very immature, very not quite grown in particular ways. And I think once we start to see, yeah, normativity and time in relationships, lots of stuff starts to unfold about how we evaluate ourselves in relation to others and in relation to life as we know it at the moment. I don't know whether there's things that either of you have thought about that are ways that chrononormativity shows up for you in your experience of yourself.
God, I mean, in so many ways, you know, and I thought about this stuff before. I think just like from the age of like when I left home, you know, and then it felt like a ticking time bomb of like, oh my God, I need to get out now. I've gone to the far end of what's normal now, you know, but then normal for my family culture might be different to the estate I live in, to the culture that we're in. But there is this kind of overarching, oh no, that's now out of the realms of normal, to like when I became like a couple, you know, and had a family, all of that stuff, like the most significant things was always matched up with a, I should be doing that stuff now, but I'm okay with not doing it. But there is this voice of, oh, why aren't you? Or it's just like, it feels constant at times if you pay attention to it. But I've always kind of rebelled against it. You know, it's always been like a relationship to it of like, that doesn't really matter, but it's that kind of thing. It doesn't matter really, but there's a nagging voice in the back of my mind of my mum's voice and my family and my culture and my history's voice is always coming into that. So it's a difficult relationship with chrononormativity. I think it's not one I've been, it's not a nice relationship. It's one I wish wasn't really a construct I wasn't really aware of in a way, in that respect, you know, like one I didn't feel like I had to measure up throughout my whole life, I think. So.
Because I think it's the implications for selfhood, that if I'm out of time, what does that speak to in terms of who I can understand myself to be within this system, within these meanings? And like, normativity doesn't really feel freeing very much, does it? It's usually a constraining force. Although as I say that, I think, oh God, maybe it produces lots of belonging for people. My doing and undoing my thinking all the time as I'm having it. Julie, you were gonna say?
I was gonna say, I think, you know, for me there's also, you know, I'm a white woman, I'm 45 years old. I think people put that time factor on you quite a lot. Like, have you got children? Have you got a partner? Do you own a home? There's certain things that people think of you as your identity, which are connected to time, of what I visibly look like, to do with my age, let's say. That even if in my head I might say, okay, I'm not buying into that, I will constantly feel bombarded by it because people ask you all the time. They're constantly wanting, it's how they choose to try and relate to you. And when you don't fit into those things, you know, I feel like it can make you feel like, well, who am I? Why don't I? And so, I mean, I definitely feel it as a battlefield at times in terms of where I'm at. And I think that's definitely related to my age and to my sexuality within that as well, of what people's expectations might be. And I'm trying to turn it, because I love, Amanda, I love your language of like how it can become more of a playground in some way for myself.
And the influence of gender, you know, the intersection of gender. So I think when I was hearing you talk, Julia, I have a cousin who's a year younger than me, and this might be very cultural, but I always was very aware of this growing up. Like, we grew up, her dad is my mum's brother. Yeah, so we're close, and we don't have much family in this country. So we were very close as kids, as cousins. And she's a year younger than me. And I just always remembered what I can now understand as like the pressure of chrononormativity on her was like, oh, the pressure on her to become a young woman and then, or to find a husband even, where for me it was like never discussed, you know, like, oh, are you going to find a wife even like my early 20s, really. It was never really even, but for her, the pressure of that, of then becoming a parent, and she was very driven. She wanted to be a police officer, but her life went a completely different. She had a child young, and she didn't have the opportunity, I think, because of the pressure to pursue what was her actual passions and interests. And it was like that kind of, what's the word? It's kind of like just intense pressure of chrononormativity and expectations. And I always remember the very difference in gender being a real kind of divide between what she experienced of this and what I experienced, you know, what I wasn't kind of put under the pressure. I'd have different pressures, but yeah, I think, and I'm wondering for if there is a real difference in gender for that.
Well, I think that's where chrononormativity hooks up with heteronormativity to create this kind of expectation of personhood and who we're meant to be. There is an assumption, if you're, you know, assigned female at birth and you become a little girl, there's an assumption that you will then become a woman, and that has certain obligations and expectations, which are often around having an opposite sex partner or opposite gendered partner. And then within your kind of cultural socioeconomic class framework, to kind of produce that heteronormativity again and again and again, and to do that. And I think what you're saying, Julie, is that heteronormativity, that expectation that a woman of a certain age is going to have a certain type of sexuality, which is going to produce family in a particular way, in a particular legal biological framework, that's heteronormativity at work. That's saying, that's really inviting you to reproduce what we know as normal in order to gain maybe the privileges of normality or the experience of belonging, or, you know, this kind of, it's really interesting to think about how much that shapes our understanding of ourselves and what's possible.
And I think, again, there's something that I think really talked to me emotionally and to my heart and my sense of my identity in regards to gender is when you talk about being pressed into molds. And I feel, you know, I think, you know, growing up for me, and I identify as female, but I've always sort of seen different genders in myself growing up, and I have queried that, but then the space to play, to explore, I think it's one of the questions that you ask, because you always ask questions, I haven't got them in front of me, of what I often wonder, if I was born in a different time and I had those thoughts, where would those things have led me to? You know, where's the playfulness, the invitation for playfulness with these things as well? And I think that's something that you offer.
I think it's what we could all offer in terms of therapy. How does the therapist allow space for all of the different ways that we're gendered, even if we are female, assigned female at birth, comfortable within womanhood, how do we still allow for different experiences of gendered and be and genderedness to be allowed? And I think that's where, you know, some of the thinking that I've done around queer theory and its impact on therapy or its potentiality within therapy is really useful, that that many of the ideas and the questions or the techniques that might come from those ideas are not just about LGBT people or queer people or marginalized people, that that I think we do, we perpetuate a sort of a division or a difference, another binary, isn't it, around kind of straight gay, and say, well, this theory and these ideas are for these people, but not for these people. And I really like, there's an Isenza paper that I often kind of give when I'm teaching called What's Queer About Sex? And it talks about how these ideas of multiplicity within our sexuality and within our gendered self are really useful for all people, not just for not just for LGBT people. So I can imagine asking you, Julie, some in a different context, some of those questions, and seeing where we get to.
I mean, I'm so glad you spoke to that, Amanda, because that was one of the things when I was preparing for this. I was like, oh, I'm so excited to think about how I can try and bring those conversations into the therapy room, not just with people who might identify as trans or come from LGBTQ. You know, these are questions and thoughts and conversations for everybody. Absolutely. Mm. I want to use some of your language because I just I love it so much. But I'm wondering if that's part of the sort of disco ball that you talk about.
Mm. Yeah, I think so. So I think, of course, language is to be kind of shared and reproduced and changed and altered. So take any language, I think, and play with it, be in that playground. The disco ball idea, I mean, first of all, I must declare that I had a thing for disco balls before I got to that theory. I think they are such a beautiful symbol of queer culture. And when I was researching for the paper, I was really surprised to learn that they came about through queer clubs in Berlin before the war, which we know was a time of really amazing kind of like gender expansiveness and sexual experimentation and kind of queer life before we think about the kind of really the first kind of book burning and censoring that happened, which was of the clinic that existed that had lots of literature. Anyway, I'm going off on a tangent. Disco balls. So I've always, from when I was a student, from when I first read the Discourses in a Mirrored Room paper, it really stuck with me as a metaphor. The idea that therapy can only reproduce what discourses are brought in it by the therapist and the people that we're working with, and that because it's such a mirrored room, because it's such a chamber, that means we're at risk of always reproducing normativity and always just bringing in, just working with the discourses that exist as we know them. And so I've always been thinking about how do we get around that? How do we bring in discourses from outside? How do we not just repeat normativity within our practice? And so obviously that combined with my love of disco balls produced this idea that I would create some kind of theory from that. But I think first of all, the idea of bringing something from the outside in, that if we don't seek out other knowledge, you know, which might be being with communities, reading books, watching films outside of our usual worlds, that help us kind of shift some of those ideas that we're carrying. This idea of the therapist as an explorer and as seeking out different ways of understanding things, I think is really important, and I think has a good foundation within thinking about that personal professional within systemic and use of self work and how we can I guess, expand what's possible within our inner conversation. But then, because I'm so obsessed with multiplicity and fragmentation, the idea of breaking mirrors, which is also a taboo, and I'm sort of aware of that. It's sort of thought about as being bad luck. And maybe there's something about taking that risk that also feels important. The idea of fragmentation and fractals and the production of rainbows through disco balls. I mean, I think that's the other thing that disco balls do is that they produce rainbows through bending lights. And so that idea of how do we break up some of those big discourses that exist about trans people? How do we allow very different understandings in the room or seek out different understandings for ourselves? That feels really important as a way to kind of, as a way to give us a task, to give us something to go on with. And also I encourage everybody to dance under a disco ball at some stage in their life.
I am getting an image of a therapy room with mirrors and then the mirror ball at the top. Oh, that'd be such a cool space to do therapy in, wouldn't it?
It's funny, after I gave the paper at the AFT conference, I got a number of messages from people saying, or a picture saying, I've bought this disco ball for the room. Or I got the most amazing thing, and I think I must get one of these, is someone managed to find like a cover for a tissue box. And of course, the tissue box is such an important artifact within therapy, covered in that kind of disco ball stuff. And I thought that's perfect. Just to remind us that there's so many different narratives and that we can't, that we are at risk of reproducing normativity, and that means power within therapy if we're not looking elsewhere.
You pose some really powerful questions in your paper, in a kind of questions to guide new explorations. And I mean, you could say no to this if you want, Amanda, but we thought it might be nice to mirror some of those, you know, to kind of bring it back to you and see what you think of how you might speak to some of those questions as well. How do you feel about that idea? We don't need to do that more, but yeah,
give it a go.
So one, well, they were all great, but one is, how do we invite each other to keep aware of the damaging effects of gender binary and the narrowing it creates in possibilities for being gendered?
It's a good question, isn't it? I think, how do we remain, because the gender binary is such a, it's a bit like that kind of fish in water. It's so much a part of our culture and our foundation of the world. It's such a big system in the way we understand ourselves and move through the world. Then it's often, I think, at the risk of becoming invisibilized. But it's one of those things that sort of, once you start to see it, every, you know, that idea that what we can focus on tends to expand. Once we see that spaces where people are divided into two and two only categories, you know, where they become an either or and not a both and, that's when we understand that gender binary is alive and creating a choice of only two for people to exist in. And so wherever we see that kind of male-female box on a form or a bathroom, that, you know, just two options, or when we're talking with a client and we ask about gender in a particular way, masculine, feminine, for instance, is another way that it shows up, then we're creating an either-or experience for people to inhabit or know themselves in. To, I think, remind ourselves and to keep expanding possibilities, we need to be thinking about gender as a both-and concept, as the potential for, yes, I mean, there's such richness and people really enjoy and love identities like man and woman or masculine and feminine. But where's the and in our talk? Where is the potential for a different way of being explored or being welcomed, that people are living, you know, that people are already living, and we welcome it into our conversation? don't know how I did with that.
I think you did really well. I think you even went on to kind of answer some of the other questions as well. So
you thought about this before, Amanda.
I think you're on top of this somehow. But I don't know if Cesar, if you wanted to ask another question because from there, because I was going towards wanting to ask Amanda about your personal kind of connection to all of this, what drew you to it, to this area.
I mean, it's really hard to find a moment or a kind of a single story about how I've ended up here talking about these things. I often joke and say, you know, my mother would say I was a very queer child and have sort of found myself inhabiting spaces of difference for loads of my life. I came out really young. I kind of knew myself as desiring people that weren't cis men from quite a young age in sort of adolescence. And so have done lots of this reckoning myself in terms of what my gender is and how that means I sort of relate to other people, fall in love, do lust, all of those lovely things. And then in my 20s, I had the glorious experience of discovering social constructionism. So it was in my 20s, I was studying to be a psychologist and ideas by like Gergen and were really, really, really important to me within a sort of a critical psychology field. And that allowed me to think really differently about identity and about gender and sexuality. And I guess to give me much more choice in how I understood that I could live these concepts, these identities, these parts of me. And from social constructionism, I found queer theory, which was just such an amazing kind of part of my life. So queer theory helps us understand that gender and sexuality are context dependent. So where we are in the world and the particular time and space we exist in is going to create lots of permission or not permission to be in certain ways. And that we're often going to have multiple strands of our experience of gender and sexuality living at the same time. And I think that's where I really relate to what you were saying, Julie, about the experience of, yes, I'm poured into this mold of woman, but within that, I can see these glimmers or these experiences or these sensations of so many other ways of doing that. And I think queer theory says to us, of course, you're going to have this multiple experience of gender and sexuality, which is going to move and change throughout time. And that was happening for me in the kind of 90s, the mid to late 90s. At a time also when I think within the queer community, within the LGBT community, loads of my friends were coming out as trans. And I had the experience of partners transitioning and changing gender. And so really having to think about how does a partner's gender inform my understanding of my gender and sexuality? How much of gender and sexuality or sexuality is to do with gender? And how much of it is to do with other things, other facets of selfhood. And so much of my work comes from having this lived experience as being a queer person in the world, being a queer femme person in the world as well. So really inhabiting femininity in a way that can be unpredictable to some people. That's sort of how I ended up here. I mean, that's my personal CV. In terms of my professional one, my first job as a psychologist in Australia, which is where I first worked and how I first qualified, was working in a project that was working with young people who had been kicked out of home for being queer in some way. And another worker went in to that family to think about whether it was safe for that person to return, if it was good for that person to return, or if it was better for them to live outside of the family. And it was a project called Reconnect, which was a big national project within Australia. And so it really got me thinking about families and queerness and gender and sexuality. And it sort of went from there, really.
And you're doing some really amazing projects and some amazing work. And your website is a fantastic resource.
One of the projects that I've been working on lately that I'm sort of the most kind of proud of is a project called More Adventures, which is a card deck which might be seen as therapeutic. It's there to kind of assist and support conversations about being trans, about gender, and it could be used by therapists, it could be used by people on their own, it could be used with a group of mates, it could be used in so many different ways. And its origin comes from a really exciting project called Adventures in Time and Gender, or adventuresintimeandgender.org. So if you go to Adventures in Time and Gender and then click on the More Adventures page, you'll find this card deck, which has 12 themes in how in talking about gender, and and really linked to the Adventures project.
Thank you. This aid for therapists to be able to talk about this stuff with families. And I wanted to bring it back again to the paper, because you talk about this recalibrating narratives of loss and this kind of these themes and discussions of loss and grief being the kind of a big part of discussions that takes place with families. And you've spoken about trying to shift that to more kind of transformative and narratives of freedom. And you make the term relational homelessness rather than loss. And I wonder if you can talk to that a bit more, Amanda.
This is, so I think, and hopefully you recognise that and other people listening recognise that when we get to somebody coming out as trans, someone knowing themselves as trans or even coming out as gay, one of the first narratives that arrives is this idea of loss and what will be lost by moving away from the kind of heteronormative standard or the kind of our expectations created by heteronormativity. And it really centers, when we're talking about trans people, it centers lots of cis experience. So it centers the experience of the people who hold the most power in the room to say, well, I think this is a loss. And by challenging that, I think what we're doing is we're decentering some of that power story and allowing some of the other things that this might be in terms of an experience for the trans person to be present in the room. And I think for that narrative to grow, I came across this kind of idea of relational homelessness listening to Susan David on a Brené Brown podcast, where she described grief as love looking for a home. And that really, I mean, first of all, it landed as an experience, as a way of describing some of the grief processes that I've been through. But there is so much kind of love in the experience of loss. And so I thought about the way that I see often when I'm working with families where someone has come out as trans, there is somebody who is experiencing this sorrowing that's happening. And I thought about it as their love looking for a new home. So much of the way that that we relate is shaped by this form of gender. If our understanding of somebody just gender shifts, then the shape of our love kind of shifts within that, or the container that holds our love, the space between us, something does change because we've been cajoled into gender shaping so much of relationship. So I thought about whether it would be more useful for parents to understand that feeling, that intensity, as a sort of a homelessness rather than a loss. And I think that loss often has this association with death and with finality. Which is not the case when we're alongside someone whose gender is changing. That there is not an experience of things being gone forever. There is an alive human with us, allowing us into their knowing of themselves. So the idea of a relational homelessness allowed for more capacity within the conversation for that experience to be temporary. For the often when I'm working, it's with a parent and a child, for them to be looking together for another space that holds their love, rather than this idea of cutting off, letting go, losing something, and then having to recreate something. It felt more collaborative. It felt more respectful to the trans person in the room who is maybe working really hard to be seen and to be known when someone else might be experiencing them as disappearing in some way. Yeah. And so I've been sort of trying to expand that concept within my work and to acknowledge, I guess in some ways we might think about it as a reframe, because we're acknowledging the distress, we're acknowledging the conditions of the moment, the emotion of the moment, but allowing them a different meaning system to exist in creates more capacity for that relationship to do something else, for that relationship to find a new home for the love that they have for each other, and how they want to share that love and experience it.
It's a really, really helpful concept. I'm thinking about a family that I've worked with where the younger brother of the family had expressed real anger, actually, because their older sibling had transitioned from being their older brother to now a trans person. And he was like, I've lost my big brother. You know, I used to be able to play football with him, and now and refuses to kind of acknowledge that a new name, a new gender, and was really, really stuck with it. And it was really, you know, embroiled in like sadness of this loss, but anger as well. Really, really difficult to shift that young person from that position. But this concept of love looking for a home is maybe a very useful one to kind of, as a seed really for that young person to kind of to grow and hold in mind. But yeah, it's making me think about, sorry, Amanda, I don't want to cut you off if you was going
to
say.
Well, I had a good question, and then maybe now it's gone, to think about what is it about the genderedness of that relationship that feels so important or precious to that person that you're working with, that young man? What is it about the kind of what's perceived as a bond between men? Why is that something that feels like it wants to be held on to? Would be a way to be thinking about that concept, that doesn't want to move.
It's making me think about the need for the future, for training, for further kind of developments in awareness around how to work with these ideas in mind. And just what your thoughts are really of it as a systemic field, where what your hopes are maybe for the future.
Well, I think loads of people within family therapy are already doing this work and doing it very well. But I think there is a kind of what I often people come to me with is a sort of a worry about getting it right. So I think first of all, in terms of, you know, if I'm doing triage in my head, the people in most distress right now are trans people who need a good therapy service and need good spaces where they're honoured and where they can think with other people about what might come next and how they want to exist in the world. So I think we do need more spaces where we are able to be resourced around those conversations. But that points as well to a kind of broader issue within systemic about maybe rethinking, recalibrating out of the kind of foundation of gender as we understand it in our practice and in our training. you know, even in our conversation now, we've talked about how these ideas are really helpful for kind of everyone. And so what would it be like in our training to go back to thinking about how to really applying social constructionist thinking to what is gender? What is this system, and really illuminating it as a system, as a structural phenomenon that guides our world and our relationships. And for me, that's kind of like the key skill in allowing more conversations to sort of come forward from that. So obviously, you know, I want everything to happen and all at once and wonderfully. But in terms of the future, I think more spaces where clinicians who are doing this work can talk with each other and think with each other and be resourced and be confident. And that includes trans therapists. You know, there are trans systemic therapists, and making sure there's room in those conversations for the trans and queer therapists that we have, and that more trans and queer therapists train as systemic therapists is also really important to me. And then in our training and in our thinking, that we really pay attention to gender in a way that doesn't reinforce a binary gender essentialist notion. Because I think we've done that very well traditionally in terms of feminist family therapy, you know, is amazing. Feminist therapy is amazing in its ability to help us think about how gender exists and how power exists. You know, and to keep going with that feminism and expand it to include gender beyond a binary notion and beyond a biological essentialist notion, I think is where we need to go in terms of training.
Thank you, Amanda. I think, it's both is one of the big things that I'm sort of taking away from this conversation with you. I just wanted as well, I mean, we will do it, won't we, anyway, Cesar, because I know that you is your website, if people want to find out more, is amandamiddleton.com. So that's full of resources to support people in terms of moving forward with these ideas.
Yeah, and my clinical home at the moment is the Pink Practice. So that's LGBTQI and beyond specific systemic practice that you can find at thepinkpractice.co.uk.
Lovely.
Thank you.
We encourage people to read the paper in Murmurations. It is a fantastic paper, and I think it should be on the reading list on all courses, qualifying courses, foundation courses.
I've given it to so many people too. I want to say, Amanda, I just think that there's a way of writing and a way of speaking that you brought to that conference, which is, for me, felt very new, felt very refreshing, felt very current and needed. So thank you.
Thank you so much. And thank you so much for having me and being part of this expansion and growing of ideas within the field. It feels really important that we're here and that we're, you know, and that we're doing this.
Thank you, Amanda. Thank you so much.
Yeah, be in touch.
Indeed. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.